Roundtable Osteuropa. Ein Podcast des Zentrums für Osteuropa und internationale Studien.
Welcome to Roundtable Osteuropa, the podcast of the Center for East European and International Studies, ZEUS, here in Berlin. My name is Fakop Matavusyan. At ZEUS, we try to make sense of political and social developments across Eastern Europe in the post-Soviet space. And in this episode, we are focusing on Armenia and its upcoming elections on June 7. Armenia is heading into these elections at a particularly complex moment. The country is dealing with the aftermath of war, ongoing security uncertainty, and external economic pressure. At the same time, we are seeing shifts in Armenia's foreign policy, close engagement with the European Union, and a more complicated relationship with Russia. And all of this is unfolding in a region that remains highly volatile, from tensions with Azerbaijan to relations with Turkey to developments in Iran. Recent polling suggests a fragmented political landscape, polarized society, and public dissatisfaction to a certain degree, which raises additional questions about how meaningful electoral choice really is in this context. So, this election is not about domestic politics, it is also about how Armenia positions itself under pressure. To unpack this, I'm really glad to be joined by Anna Ohanian. Anna is a Richard Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College and a non-resident senior scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's a leading expert on regional order, governance, and conflict in Eurasia, with a particular focus on the South Caucasus. She is the author and editor of several influential books on post-Soviet politics and regional fragmentations, and her work has been published widely in both academic journals and major international outlets, such as Foreign Policy and the Washington Post. A three-time Fulbright scholar, she has also advised organizations including the United Nations, the World Bank, and the U.S. State Department, bringing together academic insights and policy experience. Anna, great to have you with us and welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Jakob.
So Anna, let's start with a big picture. These elections are happening in a moment where different pressures, be it security-related, regional dynamics, or foreign policy shifts in Armenia, all of these are coming together. If you had to put it simply, could you please say what is really at stake in these elections, beyond just who wins?
Yes, I think on the one hand, there's a temptation to overestimate the significance of this election. So I think I would argue that we should not overestimate and should not underestimate the importance of these elections. We should not overestimate simply by, and I would like to argue here that there's great continuity as on Armenia's democratic trajectory. Armenia's Velvet Revolution in 2018 took place in a very heightened security environment. Nagorno-Karabakh conflict was not resolved. Armenia was part and remains part of Russia-centric organizations. It was part of, but Russia was much more dominant in Russia's, in Armenia's security architecture. And since then, Armenia has continued with that trajectory. Obviously, since then, the continuity is that the fall of Nagorno-Karabakh and its end through an ethnic cleansing, not a negotiated settlement, snap elections in 2021. So security environment has changed somewhat, but the fact that Armenia's democratic trajectory is taking place in a very heightened security environment, that story hasn't changed. What is different, what is us in this respect to these elections are very different, both for in terms of Armenia's past historical periods, as well as when we compare this to other post-Soviet democratic transitions, is the fact that these elections are very much about promoting the connectivity, the politics of regional connectivity in the South Caucasus. And in this regards, the stakes are very high. Many external power centers are closely watching, but this is also significant in a sense that this push for greater connectivity, infrastructural connectivity, opening of the borders will strengthen Armenia's sovereignty and contribute to create better conditions for Armenia's democratic consolidations. But these are also, we would modernize regional connectivity in South Caucasus, but all of this that I mentioned are viewed in zero-sum terms by the Kremlin. So in this respect, I also would like to challenge sort of this misconception that Armenia's elections are very much about a geopolitical pivot from east to west, from Russia to EU. That is not the story here. The story is very much about Armenia trying to diversify its foreign policy, improve its structural condition as a small state in this hierarchy of world politics, but also this will require revisiting, renegotiating its relations with Russia. And in this respect, Armenia tries to emerge as a state that is a peripheral in the new imperial system of Russian state to one of a typical, normal, small state with all the vulnerabilities, risks, and opportunities that it has. So that is, I think Russia does remain a significant factor for Armenian political trajectory, democratic consolidation trajectory, but hopefully we can unpack it later.
Great, many thanks, Anna. If I can pick up one central keyword from your talk, which is regional greater connectivity, and maybe let's unpack that for a moment. And if we zoom out, so these elections are taking place not only in Armenia, they are taking place in Armenia, but in a region called South Caucasus, where to me at least, a broader regional order is itself being shifted. So you brought Armenia's agency. Could you a little bit unpack, does Armenia still have meaningful room to act in this region? Yeah, that would be maybe my question about understanding a little bit better regional greater connectivity, which is a bit of outsider condition, but what is the room for Armenia?
Sure, that is a great question. So by regional, what I mean by regional connectivity is that over the past several years, especially in the twilight years of the Biden administration, and even before that, there was a deepening of Armenia's strategic relationship, both with the United States, as well as with European bilateral relations with Europe, with India, but also with European Union. But the key here is that United States has the Washington Accords that were signed in 2008, last summer, August of 2008. So the TRIP is an important component because number one, it reinforces the basic norms of norms against conquest, the basic norms for territorial integrity, and connects United States as a big supporter of that agreement, a broker. In that context, that agreement helps to bring the region closer to the international legal order because these basic norms, norms against conquest, territorial integrity, these norms are unevenly internalized or regionalized in various parts of the world. So this now that's number one. But number two, United States is now supporting infrastructural connectivity, rail and transit. As we speak, there is an engineering team, a company that is right now in Armenia South, Mehri, doing its work to advance the connectivity over Armenia South. So that has been significant. By creating this trip, Trump Road of International Peace and Prosperity, this helps to diversify connectivity in the South Caucasus, which up until that point, Georgia enjoyed monopoly. Actually, enjoy is not the right word, because many argued that it is an asset for Georgia, that Georgia enjoys this connectivity and connects to the Middle Corridor. But it was actually very risky for the region because that, I do argue, contributed to the democratic decline in Georgia, which started using the executive power, used its position in negotiating with external actors. So the trip helps to diversify connectivity and diversify connectivity to the Middle Corridor. And because of all of this, it helps to manage Russian influence in the region. All three states in the South Caucasus are structurally small states. They're formerly imperial states in Russia's system. So on their own, they're not going to be able to manage Russia, a very weak Russia, which is much more dangerous than Russia embedded in the international system. And the international system itself is weakening. So with all of these factors in the backdrop, these elections and this connectivity trip in particular that promotes more diversified connectivity, hopefully Armenia-Turkey border will open or trade will, Turkey will resume. all of that will modernize the region as a whole and enhance the capacity of each state in managing Russia and bigger players in general.
Great. Many thanks for unpacking and also bringing different actors into this narrative. And I would like maybe to pick up another aspect or another element of your thought, which is security. So security has clearly shaped Armenian politics in recent years, especially after the conflicts and continued tensions in the region, including not only Armenia-related conflicts, but in region-wise. So I wonder how the security concerns concretely shape that political actors, what political actors can promise in these elections. So just let's concretize with, if you have any examples about the security narratives in Armenia, that would be really interesting to hear.
So I think the big issue in terms of the security, which is relevant in this conversation, is the peace process. So the incumbent party, Pashinyan Civic Contract, has been campaigning that they are the only party that is campaigning on the peace agenda. And if they are not elected, the country will resume to war. So I would say that I would not consider, I think, up until that point, the incumbent party, Pashinyan in particular, by creating this push for the peace process, while considering, again, I think the fall of Nagorno-Karabakh through ethnic cleansing, not through negotiated settlement, is deeply problematic for the region, but also for Azerbaijani state, because it deepened authoritarianism in that country. But still, with peace process is unfolding, Pashinyan succeeded in moving the rivalry with Azerbaijan from an extreme rivalry to negative peace. There has been border delimitation in parts of the Armenia-Azerbaijan border. You have European Union civilian monitors now stationed in Armenia, which I think is the most important security policy in the region, not the Russian peacekeepers, needless to say. So with all of this policies and deepening relations, peace process is unfolding, relations with Turkey, all of this helped to move the relationship with Azerbaijan into negative peace. As to whether, so that is an important security consideration. In addition, though, this is still taking place at a time when Russia has not is stuck at a deeply imperial war of conquest. To normalize that war, Russia continues to engage in revisionist policies and essentially puts the sledgehammer over the international legal order. And all of those factors create contradictions for the Armenian state. They continue to keep the security heightened. So on the one hand, you could also argue the public support for Pashinyan in particular has declined dramatically since the 2020 war. Azerbaijani forces are parts of Armenian territory. The fall of the violent fall of Nagorno-Karabakh, even though I do think that this particular end of Nagorno-Karabakh, I firmly believe, are very much tied to Russian policies. But still, despite all of that, I think there has been very significant shift in Armenia's strategic culture, meaning the perceptions, public perceptions as to what is Armenia's security strategy, where should Armenia's security come from, what you can and cannot do with military, what you can and cannot expect from the international legal order. And I think understanding of the statehood as a concept, the value of sovereignty, the value of territorial integrity, all of these are tied to the security considerations, which I do think has been important.
Great. Many thanks, Anna. And another aspect of security narratives, as you also mentioned, in Armenia, is heavily related to Russia. So in one way or another, right? Because Russia has traditionally been Armenia's key security partner in the first three decades in the post-socialist Armenia. But that relationship has clearly been strained in the recent years, particularly within Pashinyan's government. And I'm wondering, how is Russia shaping these elections, particularly directly or indirectly? If you have any examples to make us understand that narrative, that would be really interesting to know.
I think Armenian model of democratization is very unique, and it differs from Georgia's, Moldova's, and Ukraine's. It is unique because, as you pointed out, Russia was part of Armenia's security architecture. And we'll talk about what that means. But the fact that Armenia's strategic within Armenian strategic culture, within Armenian policies, among the way Armenian political elite was talking about Russia, Russia was viewed as a guarantor of Armenian security. Actually, not on Nagorno-Karabakh, because Armenia was part of and is still part of Russia-centric organization, CSTO in particular. But see, I agree here with President Putin that those arrangements did not extend to Nagorno-Karabakh. But still, these bilateral relations, Russia's dominance over the peace process, all of these made Russia to be perceived as a central player in Armenia's security. However, Armenia's Velvet Revolution has been so fascinating because despite being part of Russia's security orbit, Armenia managed to carry out a democratic breakthrough in an authoritarian orbit. So I do have an academic article on it, and the title co-authored, and the title is How to Tame Your Dragon. So understanding how can you pull off a democratic breakthrough while being still part of a patron that is very authoritarian. So in this context now, I would not say this perception that Pashinyan is damaging relations with Russia. I don't agree with that. I think he's very, very savvy when it comes to managing Russia. Pro-Russia forces criticize Pashinyan, pro-European forces criticize Pashinyan, which indicates that he's a lot more savvy in managing Russia than some of the other political leaders in other post-Soviet republics. And the fact that Armenia remains as a part embedded in Russia centric organizations, even though it froze its membership in CSTO, it still is a member of Eurasian Economic Union, it still has bilateral relations with Russia, all kinds of things. Russia still remains dominant in Armenian economy. All of these that Russia created to entrap Armenia are now used, I'm going to use this kind of somewhat amusing term, it's a negotiation jujitsu that Pashinyan is pulling off, meaning that it is using Russian strength against it. All of this organization, it's not easy for Russia to attack, militarize relations with Armenia, because Armenia is part of these very same organizations that Russia created. This is the reason as to why Putin runs around trying to apply this binary geopolitical choice on Armenia. You're do a referendum right now. Tell us whether you're with us or with the EU, to which Yerevan is responding, we're in no way close to your European Union membership. We're not there yet. That's not a choice for us right now. We remain committed to Eurasian Economic Union. So that is the reason as to why Putin is trying to force, geopoliticize Armenia's democratic transition, which notoriously and importantly has always refused, has been a local national affair. The Velvet Revolution has not been geopoliticized from day one. And this is in sharp contrast to Georgia's, for example. In the case of Georgia, Georgia's democracy has been tied to the European path, and that complicated the challenge of democratic consolidation, which is already difficult, but when you layer it with just geopolitical polarization, it becomes an uphill battle. So Armenia so far has resisted this in keeping and shielding its democratic transition from geopolitical competition. And I think Putin is catching up. He's trying to force this on Armenian democratic system. We'll see how that unfolds. But I think the fact that Armenia is still part of Russia-centric organizations while trying to diversify its foreign policy, which every small state is supposed to be doing. You cannot find a small state that can survive without diversified foreign policy relations. But that's exactly what Putin is trying to end for Armenia. But I don't think it's successful for the Kremlin. And I don't think they should be doing that. They're overreacting. Kremlin is overreacting to what Pashinyan has been doing.
Great. It's really wonderful to see how you unpack all the narratives, you know, from different layers. And one aspect that I would like maybe to bring into discussion is the Russian propaganda. So there were a couple of reports recently that we see Russia is heavily weaponizing information against the Armenian society to polarize the society, to develop pro-Russian sentiments again. So could you say a few words about Russian propaganda and its success within the Armenian society? Is there any risk about the elections, on the outcome of the elections? Because to my understanding, within the Armenian society, there is a segment of the Armenians who still believe that Russia could be a credible security provider in the region. So that's why they will vote anti-Pashinyan. They will vote against Pashinyan. So that's the maybe small portion of the society, but nevertheless, there is this kind of anti- or pro-Russian attitude also in the society.
I think the pro-Russia attitude are quite diverse. On the one hand, there's fear that if we do not vote for pro-Russia forces, if we continue with this, would Russia finally react? The other ones are illiberal opposition parties that have economic interests tied to the Kremlin. It's not about Russia orientation. I think it's totally normal to have a political party that can argue that Armenia needs to have a special relationship with Russia. You can make that claim as long as your interests are organic, as long as there's public pressure, public support for it. So when it comes to Armenia-Russia relations, I mentioned as to how Russia, and people usually cite the inability of Russian peacekeepers to protect the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh as the failure of Russia. I agree with that, but I actually would say that the Russian liability for the Nagorno-Karabakh process is much broader. I don't want to delve on it. To those voices, I would say there's an English language saying, I don't know where it comes from. You lie to me once, shame on you. You lie to me twice, shame on me. So I think continuously going back to Russia for security provision, now handing Armenian economy and sovereignty to Russia would be strategically short-sighted and extremely myopic. The level of propaganda is vast and diverse. Even now, Putin has been publicly warning Pashinyan, and that's unprecedented. On the one hand, Russia is using the same economic pressure tactics that Russia applied on Moldova and Georgia, right? So, and I do think that Europe, as well as Armenia, because they are latecomer to this game, so they learn to regroup. And I mean, as we speak, there are already cargo that are Armenian, you see on social media, of Armenian flowers now heading to Europe instead of Russia. So I think the economic pressure is quite significant. But when you look at IRI, some of the recent polling, they actually show that support, the indicator as to whether Armenia is headed in the right direction. The over 60% think that Armenia is headed in the right direction. So that's a significant number. Advanced industrialized democracies do not have those kinds of measures, even though support for Pashinyan is still low. And I think that discrepancy is very significant. So I would say that the pro-Russia vote might be driven by fear, but I don't think a Kremlin fear-mongering, the narratives are going to resonate simply because Russia is so weakened. It is stuck in warfare. It's stuck. It's waging a war. It cannot win. It's not winning. It's a war of attrition. Domestic support for Putin is also declining. So in the poll after poll shows that its support for pro-Russia forces seems to be stuck on 20%. And that vote is being split between, it was Robert Kocharyan before, now it's Samvel Karapetyan. And I think, I don't want to predict, but I do think that those narratives will not be as successful. However, Kremlin does win in one significant way by constantly monopolizing, sucking the oxygen off of the political opposition. I mean, political, Armenia's blind spot, weakness of Armenian democracy is its weak opposition. There's no strong political party in opposition because that space is occupied by pro-Russia forces, which do not enjoy a lot of support. They're regularly campaigning on pro-Russia policies while Russia is a declining, very weak power. So I think that is perhaps not recognized, not talked about as much, but that is a very significant damage to Armenian democracy, democratic system, which then raises the question as to relying continuously on the civil society to keep Pashinyan and the civil contract party's feet to fire, essentially the challenge keeping the government accountable. That burden continues to rely on the civil society rather than the opposition forces, which are illiberal, most of them, not all.
Great. Many, many thanks, Anna. And if we now move to the West, so because Armenia's foreign policy has also shifted to the West. So And the engagement with the EU and the Western partnership, right? I mean, in the last couple of years, this is what we see. To what extent is this a real strategic shift? I wonder, because there is also this idea in the air whether this is really tactical or rhetorical shift of the Armenian foreign policy.
That is a very good question. I think overall, on the one hand, I don't think even with United States signing the strategic partnership with Armenia now, Rubio was in Armenia a few days ago, about a week ago, signing a comprehensive strategic partnership. So all of that is good, but still, and opening the doors for military cooperation, but still, if you're a voter looking for a patron, a security provider, United States is not it. And we're not in a stage, I don't think very few countries can have a reliable security patron. The logic of global organizing has shifted. And moreover, US-Europe relations are in a period of very significant shifts. Europe is emerging as a political actor that will increasingly is going to take over to develop as a security actor. United States foreign policy is also shifting dramatically. It's right now very transactional. Trump administration in particular has been pulling out United States from all range of international organizations and weakening the UN system. And it is ironic, Russia's strategy of revisionism was much more effective when United States was supporting the international rules-based world order. Because right now, United States is behaving that way, except that United States is more powerful. That basically made it very challenging for Russia to use the same tactics. In respect to U.S.-Armenia relations, I think what is really significant is growing cooperation between U.S. and Armenia in terms of semiconductors, artificial intelligence, this type of, and clearly deepening cooperation. Our cooperation I saw in agricultural effectiveness, these are significant. What was missing in the last strategic comprehensive partnership, all the language for United States to support Armenian democracy, judicial reform, which is also weakness in Armenian democracy, that language disappeared, which indicates that Armenia as a state, as a society, needs to continue to rely on itself in improving, in building new institutions of democracy to consolidate its still fragile democracy. So I think the U.S.-Armenia relations are significant, and they're not tactical, they're strategic. And I would argue that under Trump administration, there's finally a realization of the value of Eurasian continental connectivity. I've been writing about this before President Trump was elected. And the fact that United States previously had relied on its allies in various regions to project influence. But in those cases, for example, Georgia was viewed as a pivot state in the South Caucasus, and Georgia just effectively utilized it, exercised reverse leverage, and now you see authoritarian decline. So there's greater tension on connectivity, connecting Europe through South Caucasus, Central Asia. That's really important. U.S. approaches South Caucasus with China in mind, in managing its rivalry with China. And in that context, maintaining influence over supply chains, stability of supply chains, trade and transit, those are what's driving U.S. interest in Armenia and in South Caucasus. Also, there's renewed talk of critical minerals. Right now, China has an upper hand. Central Asia is a region with extensive critical minerals for the West. Central Asian relations with the United States are growing, with Europe are growing. So essentially, these are some of the reasons as to why United States is in the South Caucasus, is not going anywhere anytime soon. The agreement, TRIP agreement that they signed with Armenia was for, I forget, 49 years and then conditioned to be renewed. So these are all very big sort of agreements that are driven by industrial policy in the United States, greater engagement of the private sector from the United States. So these are all very significant measures of deepening relationship between the two and the transformation, modernization of the region of South Caucasus as a whole.
Right. So if I can pick up also two central terms from your talk, which is diversification and connectivity. So now we're speaking about not only regional connectivity, but now we are out of the region, right? Connecting to the Western Western allies. I wonder whether we can also speak about, is this a new dependency in a new form? Because if this is a step back or decoupling from Russia in terms of economy, in terms of politics, is this a new form of dependency? With a question mark, of course. I mean, I'm wondering, what would you say about this?
That is a very good question. I think, first of all, I don't think Armenia is or should decouple from Russia. Some components, I think the question is about the terms of engagement. Russia wants full control over Armenia, Armenia's sovereignty in the region, and Armenia is asserting its sovereignty. But some section of the Armenian economy is going to be connected to Russia. You have some section in the labor force, seasonal migration. They're all, Russia still continues to provide, be an important provider on energy. So there are a variety of reasons. So the question is diversifying those relationships. As to whether this is going to create new forms of dependence, I would argue no. So far, what Armenia has been doing is proving its position, its positionality in the global economic political system, improving it by making itself valuable in the region as well as in the broader Eurasian continent. So in this respect, what Armenia is doing, this is overdue. This is, Armenia is late in doing all of these policies. So as to whether Armenia will find itself in new forms of dependency, that question is very much dependent on the strength of Armenian democracy. If Armenian democracy declines and the government all of a sudden does not enjoy public support, it is in such cases that elites become sort of geopolitical patronage network. So Lukashenko is heavily reliant on the Kremlin to stay in power. Aliyev is reliant on multiple power centers to stay in power. Fortunately, Armenia's democracy does not, and Pashinyan realizes this, his legitimacy, whether we like him or not, people have been electing him. They have elected him several times. Armenian democratic electoral system is deepening, local level, municipal level, various level types of elections have been happening. So if democracy declines, it's in these conditions you will find yourself being dependent. For small states, when you ask that question, for structurally small states, some level of dependency is necessary. But the question is, who are you dependent on? Being dependent on the United States, that in general, or Europe, if you operate in that framework, Europe in particular, United States as well, I mean, there's support for state sovereignty. Of course, United States has engaged in militarized regime changes, most recently in Venezuela, but in all of those cases, or Cold War interventions, toppling a communist regime, socialist regimes that were democratically elected. But that's not what we're talking about here. I think the context is very different. And so I'm not, if you look at US-South Korea relations, that partnership, I was just in South Korea for research on my next book. South Korea alliance on United States is very long. And what is interesting, though, as South Korea democratized in 1980s, all of a sudden they're now criticism. They always debate how much should South Korea be dependent on United States for its security provision. But none of the political parties would advocate for abandoning United States or cutting off ties from United States, because South Korea has emerged, developed within a U.S. alliance system. It's not only the U.S. alliance system that contributed to the rise of South Korea. It played an important part, but it was not the only factor. But what I'm trying to say is that it is a much safer place for small states like Armenia to grow within a Euro-Atlantic system as a small state to build its sovereignty than what Armenia has already tried, being a state in Russia's new imperial system, which tends to sup out, erode your institutions. Corruption is used as a strategy. Geopolitical patronage is playing out. So I think Armenia has already been through that process. So dependency, I guess, means very different things when you talk about it in different geopolitical camps.
Great. Many thanks, Anna. As I'm really interested in diasporas in general, so I would like to ask maybe a question about the Armenian diaspora, which is quite a large and influential transnational community. So I wonder if you could say a few words about how does diaspora or diaspora communities in different continents, in different countries, shape the political environment around these elections in Armenia. If you can pick up also maybe the Russian diaspora versus the US diaspora and this elect connected to the elections in Armenia, what would you say? Is there any political discussions, political narratives that come from the Armenian diaspora into the Armenian political discourse, if any?
So I think, first of all, let me just highlight that diaspora politics is a very distinct line of scholarship. And that is not, that is, I read regularly, I follow it, but it's not my primary area of specialization. However, I would say that if you look, it does very much depend the level of mobilization of diasporic communities, the nature of their organizational density, value preferences. It very much depends on the country where they're at. So, for example, Russian diaspora, the Armenian diaspora in Russia right now is very much part of the public discourse in Armenia because there are talks and evidence that Kremlin is pressuring Russian Armenians to fly to Armenia in order to cast a vote for against Pashinyan for pro-Russia political parties, one of the three or two, whatever, depends how you count. So that's one way, that's one mechanism. In the case of United States, I think diaspora is so diverse. On the one hand, you have several what is best described as legacy institutions that have been mobilized, played an important role in keeping Armenian community together, coherent during the Cold War. But then there's also broader civic society groups in diaspora, which we don't talk about them. There's quiet voices that usually will show up for diaspora conference in Armenia every other year. So I think it's a very American or Canadian diaspora, for example, North American is very, very diverse. The legacy institutions in particular are very much have been out supporting pro-Russian political groups, largely centered around of seeing security primarily in territorial terms. They do see the fall of Nagorno-Karabakh as a security threat. That's how they frame it, at least. And unfortunately, some of them have been openly attacking the Pashinyan government, even though he has been democratically elected, whether you like him or not. But there are also other broader diasporic institutions. I think there are Armenia's economic development has been so important in terms of the diaspora investments. There are such work, it's the IT sector in particular, now the rise of AI. All of these, there's, for example, one of my favorite organizations is FAST, which has been single-handedly transforming educational system by introducing AI in various public schools in the nation. That's just one example. So I think when it comes to these elections, I think it's fair to say that legacy institutions, some of the main ones, they have been, some are trying not to state a position, but by and large, even actually after the Velvet Revolution, there has been fear that Armenia's democratic trajectory somehow abandoning Russia is going to create security risks. So they do see everything in territorial terms as opposed to Armenia's institutional sovereignty, which is Russia is eroding, is trying to erode. So that's how I see it. That's my read on diaspora politics.
Great. Many thanks for unpacking also the diaspora transnational aspect. What I would like to do maybe now, a very quick round of lightning round. So I will read out questions and I would kindly ask you to be very short in your answers. Do these elections point more toward continuity or a real change in direction?
A real change in terms of the deepening, modernizing Armenia region and elevating Armenia's position in that respect. But there's a certain level of continuity for the processes that Armenia has already started.
In these elections, what matters more, security concerns or economic pressures?
They're both the same, because increasingly in the world, economy and trade relations are being weaponized by various states, and economic pressure is found in different parts of the world. It's just Russia has been practicing it for much longer and tends to be much more blunt in its applications. I would say it's hard to separate.
Has Russia become a weaker or still central actor in Armenian politics?
I would say, I'm inclined to say that it's become a weaker player, but that does not mean that it's not a dangerous player.
Will June 7 expand Armenia's room for maneuver or confirm its limits?
I think it will improve its room to maneuver.
And last one, biggest immediate risk after the elections?
I think it's going to depend Armenian security institutions, whether they can, how well they can manage a lot of the hybrid threats coming from Russia. But in much of my writing, I always do see primary security risk for Armenia is a declining authoritarian, personalized petro state in Azerbaijan, in Aliyev's regime. So I think that will remain. I do see that as a risk, and managing it is going to remain important.
Great. So now I have another question. So we stay on June 7 on election day. But if we look beyond election day, so the next day, what should we really watch for after June 7?
I think the day after, things will become a lot more normalized. I think the temper tantrums from Russia will calm down. And I think Russia hopefully will learn that the more it pushes Armenia, the more Armenia is going to find alternatives. And I do expect a new round of Armenia-Russia relations, recalibration. But at the same time, I think at the global level, we have to watch for what is going to the nature of relationships, how the war in Ukraine will be managed, saying that it will, some sort of ceasefire agreement will be signed. Even if a ceasefire agreement is signed, that border is already militarized, Russia is stuck. A lot can happen inside Russia. So I do think that on June 11th, this process will continue, modernization and opening of the South Caucasus, and continuing with this path will be beneficial for Armenia.
I wonder what would genuinely surprise you after June 7th?
I think I'm not yet sure about, I can't make predictions about the size of the elections. I do expect that Pashinyan may win despite the low support that he has. I do think that he might win by much larger margin than people expect. That's one way, but there's also, I don't know what to expect from all the Russian Armenians that are forced to come to Armenia and vote. I don't know how that's going to play out. I don't think we're going to see post-election protest activity, but if I did see high levels, I would be surprised. Because I think Armenia, last time I was in Armenia, which was a few weeks ago, it strikes me as kind of confident, very positive. There's massive massive development happening in various parts of the country. People are invested, whether it's through healthcare policies, whether through subsidized loans they're getting to purchase an apartment. People are invested in the system. So I expect an easy transition on June 8th. So I would be surprised if there are any protests or rallies.
Great. And as you mentioned many times that you're working on a new book, so maybe also let's use a couple of minutes to unpack your current research, which is about countries like Armenia, small states that operate politically under sustained external pressure. I wonder what Armenia will tell us as a small country about this whole situation. Do we see any patterns with other post-Soviet countries? You mentioned a couple of aspects, but I wonder if there is any singular pattern that it would maybe bring here compared to elsewhere, and whether is this part of a wider post-Soviet trend, what is happening in Armenia?
I developed this interest in writing this book on small state agency after watching Armenia's very specific move to join International Criminal Court, ratifying the Rome Convention. Everyone thought that was a geopolitical suicide, and I thought Armenia is going to proceed with this. People were afraid that this is a geopolitical suicide because in the same week that Armenia announced its intention to join International Criminal Court and ratifying all of the convention parliamentary politics, a process that it started several years before that, ICC issued an arrest warrant on Putin. So the arrest warrant on Putin came, and then Armenia announced it is going to ratify Rome Convention. So I thought that many thought that this is insane on Armenia's part, but I thought that actually makes a lot of sense for Armenia to move ahead with this and that Russia pressure can be managed. So that's how I started researching. So I don't have a lot of answers right now. I've done field work in Turkey, in South Korea, and I plan on spending, with this last Fulbright grant, I plan on spending a month in Japan. But basically my argument is that this world order formation that is going on, all this turbulence that we see, is very much going to be dependent on regional orders, and middle powers in particular. Turkey, the way Turkey relates to a smaller state in its neighborhood. We've talked about Russia, the way Japan and South Korea relate to a smaller state in their neighborhood. So I think on the one hand, when you look at the small state scholarship, Armenia's current foreign policy trajectory makes a lot of sense. So Armenia is in the process of emerging from a peripheral state in Russia's imperial system to becoming one part similar, a small state in a world system. That's the transformation that is happening. And in that context, small state security strategy require diversified foreign policies. They require niche diplomatic engagement. They require, look at Taiwan. Nobody can touch Taiwan because Taiwan is so central, provides like over 90% of semiconductors for the global economy. So building Armenia is in the process of improving, enhancing its position in the world economy. TRIP is important. I view TRIP in the context of small state strategy. So I will know more in a couple of months as I process my data. I haven't had a chance to go over my interviews. And that's actually, I will be starting doing that as of tomorrow after I finish this round, more precisely next week after the election is over. So I won't be obsessing about it.
Great. I'm really looking forward to the book to read because I'm really interested, as you said, like the ages in small countries to see what is happening with the country of Armenian Republic. And let me end on this, bringing back elections once again, and then finish the podcast. So what do these elections tell us about the future of politics in places where security, geopolitics, and democracy are tightly intertwined?
That is, you can write a whole separate book about it. There are several huge literature on it. I do think that countries like Armenia, I think we already saw the democratic decline in Georgia is very, very unfortunate, very sad and very dramatic, but it really indicates the challenges of building democracy in a heightened security environment. And in this case, in case of Armenia, I think Russia, because Armenia is democratic, perhaps not consolidated, captures the opposition space, opposition political parties, and therefore makes it difficult and poor Armenian democracy to consolidate. So I think that is a question to always consider and look for. At the same time, I think the conflict with Nagorno-Karabakh in 2020, 2023 heightened the awareness for people that we do need to take ownership of our state. That legitimacy is important, and the push against the government, even coming from electoral illiberal forces, I think has crystallized this political culture of constant keeping the government accountable, constantly pushing. So I think there are a variety of ways by which security can threaten democracy, but I think Armenia's democratic model is much more resilient simply because it emerged in a very tough Russia's security orbit. So it's a tried model. Moving forward, the major threat, weak opposition, political, real, organic opposition, the temptation of the current, if Pashinyan is elected and reelected and with a big margin, then the possibility for Armenian democracy being stuck as a single party democratic system, that's not a good outcome for Armenia's democracy. So if opposition is not going to develop, then Armenia continuously is relying on civil society to push against the government. And there's new research emerging that actually is much more important than even political parties. We're going to see civil society becoming more complex. We're going to see trade unions forming, professional associations forming, and all of this is going to be very important in keeping the pressure, keeping accountability over the government and over the executive.
Anna, thanks so much for your insights and for your ideas. This really helps put the Armenian elections into a broader and more nuanced perspective. And thanks to all of you for listening. This was Roundtable Osteuropa, the podcast of the Center for East European and International Studies, SOIS. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye.